Okay, I hope everybody is back and has done whatever they need to during their break. And it's time for Philip to tell us about Jungfraujoch. Philip, you're on.
Thank you, Herbert, for organizing this workshop and for the opportunity to speak today. Welcome, everyone. In this half an hour presentation, I would like to give you an idea about work at the PSI on FPGA-based detector data acquisition. But I would like to also spend half of this talk actually talking about some ideas in compression and what we could do probably better in the future in this regard. So, but starting with FPGAs and data acquisition, at PSI, we face the problem that we can actually double our, on average, we double every 2 years data rates coming from our detectors. This becomes a problem in terms of handling of the data rates because computers don't increase their capabilities that fast. So in 2022, we are planning to have a 10 megapixel Jungfrau detector that we need to integrate into our beamlines. And this detector operating at full 2 kilohertz speed will generate 46 gigabytes per second. And we are already working on ensure a smooth integration of this detector into our beamlines. And we are already working on a 4 megapixel system to make sure it can run for experiments. Now, what you need on the data acquisition side, what you need to get the data from a detector is you need to first be able to catch the packets coming from the network and save them somewhere. Specific to Jungfrau, there is a need for conversion from raw pixels that are generated by the detector to energy or photons. There is a need of a peak finder. There is also a need of a pre-compression filter, and there is a need to write all those things to memory. Now, the thing that is also specific for the Jungfrau is that it needs to operate at high frame rates, above 1 kilohertz, and you can only do summation after this conversion step from raw to energy photons. So this step has to work at above 1 kilohertz, even if at the end of the day, we would like to get 1 hertz frame rate, so 1 image per second, we still need to be able to operate at 1 kilohertz. And all of the tasks that that I show here on this slide, they are simple. They don't have computational complexity, but they have very high throughput. And we actually measured this. So that the graph on the right is actually quite important. It shows it's for a conversion of photons from raw Jungfrau to converted. And on the y-axis, it shows computational complexity. And this large purple dot is actually our loop. And from this graph, we know that we could be 40 times faster in terms of the capability to do calculations, just multiplications and additions. However, this line, the tilted lines, they denote the memory bandwidth. So how fast the CPU can actually get the data. And here there is a problem that we hit the capabilities of the CPUs that we are working on. So doing even the conversion itself on a CPU is limited by the amount of data we can stream in and out of the CPU. The memory bandwidth becomes a problem and not the actual computational power. So the thing is that even if I have more cores, but I don't have more memory bandwidth, this will not help me anyway to do this task. So we started to look into different ways of realizing the data acquisition and conversion. And we looked into FPGAs because they are real-time designs. So they are designed to guarantee throughput and latency. So if we get data at whatever 100 gigabits per second, we are guaranteed that the FPGA will actually process them at this speed. They have very fast memory bandwidth. They have fast I/O options, so you actually can have Ethernet on the FPGA board directly connected to the FPGA. There's no need to route the packets from the network to the CPU and only then to a GPU, for example. So we really found that FPGAs are great, but there's also an effort in developing things on the FPGA that is bigger than on CPUs or GPUs, just because most of us are trained and have experience working with CPU programming, doing C or Python, but not many people have actually experience with designing FPGAs, and these are electrical engineering skills. So there is a difficulty. And we found a way actually to go around this difficulties with a technology called OpenCAPI and also some other FPGA enhancements in the last years. So first I want to talk about OpenCAPI, which is this cable, this yellow cable here that connects FPGA to an IBM CPU. And this is a feature that is specific to IBM CPUs. And to introduce OpenCAPI, I first need to talk about something called virtual mode. This is something that the CPUs starting from 286 are doing. They hide, there are two ways to address memory on a CPU system. One way is physical. So we just have a certain number of memory chips, and we are just, we have a physical addressing. But then there's something called virtual addressing. And virtual addressing, introduced in this 286, 386, hides complexity of the physical addressing. So if I write a program currently, as a C or a Python program, I have no idea how much memory actually physically my system has. I don't need to know if I share memory with other processes running on the system. I can ensure that I'm safe, that only my process can access its own memory and not the other processes. They cannot steal my memory. And it's actually because that there needs to be a way to relate this to address spaces, this virtual and physical address spaces. And this is done by electronics in a CPU. And the whole deal with designing peripherals is that if we work with a PCI Express, that is a common way to design peripherals, they do not talk virtual address space. They talk on a physical. And this is for me as a developer to ensure that I properly do this translation between physical and virtual. And OpenCAPI allows me to connect my FPGA directly to the virtual address space of the process and reduce complexity. And I don't want to go into too many details, but I just want to say that with this technology, we were able to move the FPGA development from something that is a domain of electrical engineering into something that is a domain of actually software design. And that we can use our skills as software designers, as software developers, to actually develop things on FPGA. And this makes things much faster because, for example, we have things like continuous integration and automatic tests, and you can use them as we want in this development process. So we have actually, with this technology, we were able quite quickly and with a relatively low manpower as looking into an FPGA project to make a system that is capable of up to 50 gigabytes per second. Now, currently it's verified for 20, but this is just with two FPGA boards, and the system is capable of actually having four boards installed, and then it should scale to 46 or 50 gigabytes per second. The system produces gold standard. We HDF5 files at the output. That's quite important for us to ensure that when this detector comes into user operation, actually users can use the files with the software that they are currently working with. I already verified it's working with Negia, it's working with Albula, it's working with Dials. So thanks to Negia, it works with XDS. And it passes validation for Nexus metadata. So we hope that when it starts user operation, it will be fully Nexus compliant. And we've already collected data. We have collected recently data actually in Japan, in Photon Factory. We have a very good collaboration with Japan. We have collected there more than 2,000 data sets for a real life native SAT project. And the support of the detector was done remotely from Switzerland. If you want to learn more about results of this project, Sylvain has a presentation during IUCR about, he will show some of the results that we actually got with Jungfrau. I'm very happy that these are not only test crystals, but this is actually an actual biology project that we could advance with using Jungfrau at Photon Factory. So there is, I have the slides actually as a courtesy from IBM. And there is a gain in using this FPGA technology in terms of both the throughput that we can get, but also price and power consumption. And if we can prove really this 46 gigabytes per second, this 10 megapixel system, then we have an order of magnitude gain over traditional CPU-based server. And now I would like to change gears and talk something about compression, because having the FPGA pipeline is great, but at some point we have to write these files somewhere, or we have to transfer them somewhere. This is what Herbert said, that we will have a problem of storing and transferring the files. And compression is an important step to actually reduce the size of data to be transferred or stored. Now, currently what we are using is BitShuffle LZ4. There are few interesting projects in the community. I just want to mention three. I mean, there is a scientific lossy compression that is being worked for within an XFL framework. There is a project on also at Argonne on on-chip compression of X-ray data following counting statistic. This is currently used by imaging community, but this is something that we should also have a look for our community, how well this compression can work. It takes into account that the counts we measure are following counting statistics, and then some simplifications can be made. And there's also an interesting a new project from RIKEN and Florida State University about using recurrent neural networks to speed up compression. And the first question would be, are we as an HDRMX community ready to embrace this development? I'm pretty sure that we'll need to do a lot of work to convince our users that these algorithms actually can work. But also, I myself started to ask the question, are there simple things that we could do to actually make compression better? And this is what I want to show in the next slide. So what we usually do with Eiger data or with Jungfrau data is we use LZ4, a popular lossless compressor. But to make actually LZ4 working well, we first apply a bit shuffle. That is a pre-compression filter. So it makes compression easier, but it does not reduce the data. It just, I will show on the next slide how bit shuffle works. And then after a bit shuffle, we can apply LZ4 and get a good compression ratio. So starting with LZ4, LZ4 is just going through a diffraction image byte by byte and looking if there are repeatable sequences of bytes which can be replaced by some tokens. So it is designed for texts. So it's just looking for words that are common. And then these words are replaced with tokens. The problem is that for diffraction images, actually long byte sequences are very unlikely to happen. There's no guarantee if we have one that after one, there has to be another one or two or zero. So what we do is this bit shuffle filter. So in a bit shuffle, let's say we have 8 pixels to compress, we write them in binary. And then we move the least significant bits to the end. So we move this one here, we group all of the blue bits here, the last one. Then we group the second least significant bits in the next one, and next one, and next one. So with this way, we are actually ending up with a lot of zeros, because it is actually quite unlikely that we will get very high numbers in the diffraction image. Most of the things that we work with are actually zeros or low numbers because of the background, and black spots are kind of unlikely. So we will have here something that is more or less zeros. And then we'll have a part that is that has very different bytes here, which will not compress very well. How we actually implement the bit shuffle is there is no single instruction on a CPU to do bit shuffle. It is implemented as a series of bit operations. However, bit shuffle is very fast. It is gigabytes per second. It's around between 2 or 3 gigabytes per second to bit shuffle a data on an Intel CPU. But if compression becomes very fast, so if my compressor works at 0.5 gigabyte per second, I don't care if I apply bit shuffle and compression or just compression. I will have a 0.5 gigabyte per second. But if my compressor is very fast, let's say my compressor can do 5 gigabytes per second, then bit shuffle becomes a problem, becomes a challenge. And with an FPGA pipeline, I can actually do a bit shuffle on FPGA because it's trivial, because it's just changing the wires. So I change the order of bits. And this is one way of speeding things up. The other thing is about LZ4. So LZ4 is a perfect algorithm because it's very fast to decompress. It's simple, but it's also old. Actually, there is a newer development. So the author of LZ4, Yann Collet, he moved to Facebook. And at Facebook, he wrote a new algorithm called ZStandard that learns from experiences of making LZ4. Now, the biggest difference is that ZStandard is more flexible. Now, LZ4, if you played with LZ4, you can set different levels of compression. And this is tested on some general compression data. Actually, setting this level of compression of LZ4 doesn't really change how well you compress the data. It only changes how fast you compress. But for ZStandard, actually changing the level of compression actually can change. So you can ask either for a slow but strong compression, or weak compression but very fast. And this actually is proven on diffraction data. So I took a lysozyme data set, and for LZ4, I get, this is bundled with bit shuffle, I get compression ratio of 7 and throughput of 2.5 gigabytes per second. Now with ZStandard, by changing the level of compression, so that the strength of compressor, I can get to 8 times compression, but much slower than LZ4, or I can get to a compression ratio that is similar to LZ4 and the throughput that is similar. Now, in general, ZStandard is not as good as LZ4, so either in compression ratio or in throughput, but this option that if I get more resources, I can actually compress my data better, and I can make these trade-offs, it's actually quite cool. The other small, there was a discussion about chunking before. Actually, ZStandard can benefit from larger chunks. So if I would do a block of 1 megabyte for ZStandard, I can reach a compression ratio of 9 times compression with a higher throughput, because every time, so for the compressors, the better the compressor is compressing, it's also faster. I mean, that there is this kind of thing. Okay. And LG4 doesn't gain from large block size. So one thing, if I bit shuffle my data on FPGA and then I run LG4, I already gain. So instead of 2.5 gigabytes per second, I can get 4 gigabytes per second if I just move this operation of bit shuffling to FPGA. And then if I write my own Z standard compressor, that the only thing that this compressor does is look for sequences of zero in a bit shuffled image, assuming that the bit shuffling was done on FPGA, I can get a bit worse compression ratio as the LZ4, but I get a throughput that is close to 8 gigabytes per second. And this is a throughput where I can start thinking about actually having this 46 gigabytes per second in a single system. So I think this result shows that really the compression, what it's doing is compressing after bit shuffling is compressing zeros. It's also compressing the non-zero part, but this takes a lot of effort to actually compress this non-zero part. And this zero part is most of the compression and it's the easiest part. And there comes a single issue with doing this kind of pipeline for us. So as you know, the modules of Eiger and Jungfrau are 1024 types 512 lines. However, these pixels on the boundaries of chips are actually larger. So to do the processing, we actually need to enlarge them. So they are replaced with 2 or 4 pixels. And this results in an image that is 1030 times 540. And this is a big issue. First of all, because chunking of 1024 times 512 is easy, and chunking of 1030 times 514 is difficult because there is less divisors. But it's also because doing this operation to enlarge this thing on the FPGA is difficult. So what I'm currently doing is I'm working on a plugin to actually enlarge these pixels on reading of the image rather than during acquisition. And I'm currently thinking if there is a more so to have an HDF5 plugin that actually will add these things. And also the gaps between modules are a big issue. And I really think that segments in the gold standard are an answer to define geometry and not place these gaps. So thank you for listening to the presentation. I wanted to show you that we have an FPGA-based solution for data acquisition, and that there is a space actually to get better in terms of compression. And I also would like to acknowledge multiple people that were involved in this effort. People from other facilities. We had great help from KK. We have great discussions with Max 4, Aaron and Graham. They help with the standards. We have also discussions with ESRF on Power 9s, with Dectrees to help to ensure that our the files we produce are compatible with Eiger, and IBM was also helpful in this presentation, in this work. So thank you, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Questions, people? All right, I will ask a question, which is not actually for you. It's for our friends at Dectrees, which is, would you be willing to provide simply the option of Z standard along with everything else? It is a fully available plugin There's no reason not to use it, and seems very worthwhile from, you know, this talk and other experiments that Z standard is worth having available as an option.
Sorry, I just had to connect my headset again. Yes, I mean, generally speaking, if the community can agree on a lossy compression or something similar, I mean, I don't see a reason why we wouldn't want to support that.
Okay, thank you. John, you have a comment.
Yeah, thank you very much for the talk. With respect to the lysozyme example, it suggested to me, perhaps wrongly, that the thing you were evaluating was the level of compression that led to fidelity of the results with respect to the structure. But the question is the level of compression related to the size of the crystal unit cell?
Certainly, if the unit cell is larger, you will have more Bragg spots.
That's the nub of my point.
But first comment, just to make sure, all of these algorithms are lossless. It's only about the compression ratio and throughput. There is no information loss here. And regarding larger unit cell, it's actually a good experiment for us to do and try compression ratios and throughputs on a system which will have larger unit cell, more information in it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Any other questions? Okay. It sounds like we have a charge before us for the discussion, which is people to be more involved with the compression issue. And so I hope people will stick around for the discussion at the end, and maybe we can make a little working group for people who are interested in the issue of improving on the compression, because it definitely needs improving. It is not just the Bragg spots that are an issue. It's simply the background dome. That causes, you know, that causes tremendous sensitivity to the, you know, the way the compression is done. And there are a lot of issues, and our own experiments in NSLS2 suggest that Z standard is a very good direction to go. It has the adaptability to deal with the increasingly wide range of diffraction data we have to deal with. So I think it's a very good idea to explore it. More questions? John, your hand's still up.